Coming to America was a huge hit when it was released in 1988, debuting at number one and eventually grossing well over $100 million at the box office. It captured Eddie Murphy at the peak of his career, helped catapult Arsenio Hall into a new level of stardom, and it has since inspired countless homages. Now, 33 years later, the sequel Coming to America, as in the numeral 2, has arrived on Amazon Prime, reuniting most of the original cast and adding some new faces like Wesley Snipes and Leslie Jones. Can Prince Akeem and friends recapture the magic of the original? I'm Ayesha Harris, and today we're talking about Coming to America on Pop Culture Happy Hour from NPR. Here with me are the former hosts of The Nod with Brittany and Eric on Quibi, Brittany Luce and Eric Eddings. Hello and welcome back to you both.
Hey, it's good to be here.
It's great to be here. Thank you so much.
So, in the original Coming to America, Eddie Murphy plays Akeem, spoiled prince of Zamunda, a fictional African country. Yes, it is fictional, in case people don't realize this. On his 21st birthday, he is expected to marry a bride selected by his parents, but Akeem is determined to ditch his sheltered life and travel abroad to find true love and himself. He and his best friend and personal aide, Semi, played by Arsenio Hall, head to Queens, New York, where cultures clash and hilarity ensues. Now, when the sequel begins, Akeem and Lisa, played by Shari Headley, have three daughters, and King Joffrey, played by James Earl Jones, is on his deathbed. Thanks to some convoluted cinematic retconning, Akeem learns that during that first trip to the U.S. all those years ago, he unknowingly fathered a son named Lavelle, played by Jermaine Fowler. Akeem brings Lavelle and Lavelle's mother, Mary, played by Leslie Jones, back to Zamunda in order to groom Lavelle to become the next in line to the throne. So even though 30-plus years have passed, most of the original cast has returned for the sequel. There are tons of direct references to the first movie's scenes and jokes as well. Don't worry, Murphy and Hall's barbershop guys, the Reverend and Randy Watson and the Sexual Chocolate Band are all back. It's also stuffed with new cameos and side characters. Wesley Snipes, Tracy Morgan, Morgan Freeman, Tiana Taylor, In Vogue, Salt-N-Pepa, Gladys Knight, even Colin Jost star in this. Craig Brewer, who most recently directed Dolomite Is My Name, takes over for John Landis, while producer Justin Canoe and Black-ish's Kenya Barris are credited on the screenplay with the original movie screenwriters Barry W. Blaustein and David Sheffield. Brittany and Eric, I know you both have a history with this movie. You actually did an episode of The Nod way back dedicated to this movie. What are y'all initial impressions of this sequel? Brittany, let's start with you.
Okay, look, Coming to America is a classic. It's an American classic, and I think it would be hard to create a follow-up that was as compelling as the first. I will say, in many aspects of the film, they give a good effort. Like, it's nicely shot, even though it was shot in Georgia. It doesn't look like cheap. Sometimes I think when you shoot one place for another, it can have this kind of cheap look. The costumes were also done by Ruth Carter, who's like obviously a titan as far as not just costuming for Black people in cinema goes. And, you know, some of the pieces and jokes work really nicely. And it's good to see some of those throwback characters from the original again. But I just think that the story needed a little bit more love than I think that it got. I wish they had taken a few aspects of the story in a different direction. It kind of felt like sometimes they were going for this kind of feminist girl power message while also just giving Prince Akeem a son and following his whole emotional journey, which seemed to kind of undercut the whole feminist premise. And the other thing too is that like one of the aspects of Coming to America, the first movie that I thought was really sly was like putting the African and African-American cultural clash together, but doing it with like bougie new money Black people and like, you know, putting that next to African royalty. And I thought that the first movie got a lot of mileage out of that. And I wish that there had been kind of an equally clever sort of cultural clash that was depicted in the second film. I think that like Africans and African-Americans have come a long way in terms of how we sort of regard each other. And I think that like, I wish that the movie had been a little bit more representative of some of those conversations. So overall, it was like, I would say like minus a couple jokes that I found particularly offensive. If you have a lazy Saturday and you're, you know, you kind of want to go down memory lane, why not watch it? But if you're expecting the first movie, that's not what you're going to get.
Well, yes and no, because there are a lot of direct jokes that are just completely lifted from the first, especially in the first like 10, 15 minutes before it kind of lets loose a little. But I hear you on that. Eric, how about you?
I actually think Brittany is really generous. Like, I really struggle with this movie. And it's tough because I have so much reverence for the first one. To me, like, the big issue with Coming to America, I was that it kind of forgot what people really loved about the first one. To Brittany's point, you know, in the original movie, Black Americans actually were the joke. We were the butt of the joke. Mm-hmm. Prince Akeem was consistently subverting the ideas that Black Americans had, you know, that are kind of rooted in this, like, single story of what we understand about Black people who come from Africa. And he was kind of just showing them, like, no, like, you guys are strange, you know? Like, what's happening to your couch after you wear this jerry curl and you get up, you know? Like, to Brittany's point, like, the kind of the bougie new money aspect, even, like, John Amos and his, like, quest for kind of entrepreneurship and, like, to subvert, like, the power that McDonald's had by creating McDowell's. In this movie, in the sequel, they make Africans the joke. And they do that using some of these, like, really, really tired kind of, like, tropes that we see over and over again. Literally, you have warlords, patriarchal monarchies, somebody tries to cut the whiskers off a lion. You know, like, what are we doing here? Watching it, I felt like the literal kind of embodiment of the woozy face. And I think a lot of that is just because it felt like everyone in the film was either kind of frozen in time for 33 years or had, like, almost, like, regressed in a way. And it just really kind of left you with this, like, wait, are you telling me in 33 years, like, Prince Akeem has learned nothing? And additionally, like, the patriarchal, like, themes that they push back on a little bit, like, there's a lot from Princess Mika who's trying to, like, push Akeem to change some things in Zamunda.
And Princess Mika is played by Kiki Layne, who people may recognize from If Beale Street Could Talk. She was the lead in that movie. She looked amazing here.
she is amazing in the movie, but she's given so little to do that, like, her pushback, it feels like they just kind of wrote those lines into the movie because if they didn't, people would raise hell for it. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, outside of Princess Mika, the only real voice for, like, progression or change is Sherry Headley, you know, who's playing Lisa McDowell. And she's, again, she's great in the film. It was nice seeing her have, like, something to do. Whereas, like, I think in the original film, she was kind of in it, but everything really revolved around, like, Eddie and Arsenio Hall. So it was nice having her feel like an emotional anchor for the movie. But again, it was in such, like, weird little pockets that things just overall felt kind of, like, strange or like they came out of nowhere. Yeah. If there is a Saturday afternoon where I'm going to watch this movie, I almost wish I just had never seen the original first, because, like, they're just so different. Like, there are things you can love about it, but it just makes me be like, oh man, they really did get it right that first time.
Yeah. And it's kind of just a stroke of luck that they got it right, right? Like, I feel like we can't undersell the fact that this was Eddie at his peak, and this mm-hmm. movie, it did really well at the box office, but I think it's done even better in part because it was always on TV, like, all the time. Like, it was impossible not to see this movie playing on, like, TBS or something. Like, it was always on. And I feel like that's sort of what has made this movie so indelible and also been passed down from generation to generation. I take both of your points, and I think that they are absolutely valid. Like, I think there were definitely moments where I cracked a smile. It was great to see James Earl Jones. I'm glad he's still with us. Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't think it's a spoiler to say at the beginning of the movie, he passes away. And I think that scene was probably one of the funniest because yeah. like the giant funeral at the beginning is just while he's still alive. And then he, you know, it's. I thought that was really great. And I think that the choreography by Fatima Robinson, who is yes. like just a legend, yes. was fantastic. And we already pointed out Ruth Carter's costumes. But I think to me, that was the best part of this. Like, I just thought it was beautiful to see all of these beautiful Black people in all these costumes. I do want to ask you, because I feel like there will probably be a lot of think pieces on this, but the whole premise is based on, well, first of all, we go back and we see scenes directly from the original film
yeah.
a few times. And the first time we see that is, you know, the infamous scene when they're Semi and Akeem are in the club going out and looking for dates. And it's told in flashback. And it turns out that Leslie Jones's character basically drugged Akeem and then had sex with him. And he didn't realize this. Mm-hmm. And so I'm having flashbacks to Bridgerton discussion about like consent, especially when it comes to men and women. I just feel like that part was kind of queasy to me. And I was like, I don't understand how this is like being played for laughs. It's a little bit awkward and weird. What did you all think?
Okay, so I think that that specific scene is kind of emblematic of like all of the larger issues of the film that each of us has brought up, sort of the clunky feminism, put feminism in quotations, the unevolved conversations, and to Eric's point, the regressed conversations between African-Americans and Africans. Like some of the humor, even some of the smaller bits and jokes. There was like a bit in there about circumcision that I think they meant to be subversive, but was stereotypical and also just like 20, 25 years ago to me, as far as the humor was concerned. I feel like comedy's come a longer way than that.
It felt kind of Scary Movie-ish to me. It was like, are we really doing this?
Exactly. Yeah. But yeah, the thing is that like, I just, the humor to me felt like, and that specific scene, and I think a lot of the way that people might think about that scene morally, like I think that people who are millennials and younger are probably going to take a big issue with that. And I felt like that scene to me felt like something out of the 90s or the 80s that would have flown back then. And I didn't like it. It made me uncomfortable. And I felt like that was a strange way to start their family relationship. I felt maybe feel weird about Leslie Jones's character. Weird being an understatement. Also made me feel weird about how they all sort of accepted each other as family. I just thought that I thought it was lazy. But I would be curious to hear from somebody who was like in their 50s or 60s, mm-hmm. who to me, it seems like this movie was really made for.
Yeah.
And it's fascinating to think that they would think about this movie in that way. Aisha, to your point, you said that like people have been watching this movie. It's been passed down. So it's been appreciated by a massively wide audience. So to kind of come into it with this really kind of narrow and antiquated like view of how to approach the comedy, it's confusing to me. So that scene was I really particularly struggled with. But something smaller that also kind of was indicative of that treatment was the reintroduction of Vanessa Bell Calloway's...
Imani.
Yes, Imani. So there was so much kind of talk, I think even around the original movie, about the subservience that she kind of displays. Well, you know, whatever you like, Prince Akeem. You know, I will do what you want. I will hop on one leg. And so, you know, kind of going back to this idea that they've frozen everything in time, Vanessa Bell Calloway's character, Imani, has not changed. She is literally still hopping on one leg. And so it's tough for me to believe any of the feminism that is kind of spoken to or alluded to in the film when the actual reverence for almost all of the female characters within it is just so little or low. The other thing that's frustrating about it is like, the job of the female characters in the film is kind of like to push, you know, the male characters forward. But almost in every scenario, they don't listen to them. And it's only after a man reinforces the exact same thing that they said that there is any actual progression. So it's just like one of those things like, well, did they want to have their cake and eat it too? And also like, why are you obsessed with this type of cake? You know, like, what is it about this humor that feels so important to you that 33 years later you have to continue to reintroduce these ideas?
Yeah, and I think your point about the fact that it's a man who who they finally listen to, that man is Jermaine Fowler's character. He's LaBelle, and he's the American. And that speaks to your point earlier about the way in which this kind of perpetuates these stereotypes about Africans versus Black Americans, that Black Americans are somehow more progressive. And it's a very one-dimensional way to look at things. And I don't think it's going to help this sort of like divide that kind of already exists between Black Americans and Africans. Mm-hmm. Like they didn't quite call anyone like derogative names, but it did feel as though, especially Wesley Snipes' character, and Wesley Snipes is playing a warlord basically. Oh, and there's jokes about him like giving little kids guns and stuff. And I'm like, it feels regressive. So I completely agree with you all. Of the new characters, is there anyone that you particularly liked?
I think that Mika, who's played by Kiki Layne, and also LaBelle, played by Jermaine Fowler, I liked both of their characters and I liked both of those actors. I think that the film did them a disservice by making them brother and sister. I actually think that Kiki Layne should have been like in graduate school in New York or Los Angeles or someplace else in the United States. And I think that she should have met Jermaine Fowler and they should have dated. Because, like, I did like, this is, I mean, I'm just being honest. Like, I thought that the woman, I think Marimbe, who they made Jermaine Fowler's love interest, she was cute. But she was also, like, she had no agency. She, at the drop of a hat, she was, like, ready to move to the United States and marry some dude that she had just met 3 days before.
She did want to start her own barbershop.
But, you know what? I mean, I feel that. But I'm like, could she have had a barbershop in Kenya? Could she have had a barbershop in South Africa? Did she have to just meet the first broke Black American man and go back to Queens with him? But I have a lot of bones to pick with the original film and the way it treated female characters. The first film also reinforced a lot of really negative stereotypes about colorism. Mm, yeah. The way that dark-skinned women are treated in the first Coming to America film, like, to me, that didn't give me high hopes for the second film. I think my expectations, like, the bar for me was in hell. because usually sequels that you have huge gaps in time in between don't necessarily wow the second time around. Yeah. But also, like, a way to subvert that would have been to focus on Kiki Layne, put her in the United States, and, like, follow her as she sort of, like, tries to figure out how to date Black American men. That's a movie I'd watch. That's a movie I'd watch.
Maybe we've got a third movie to
come on. Let's just ignore this one and skip straight to three.
Yeah. Well, there you have it. Tell us what you think about Coming to America. You can find us on Facebook at facebook.com/PCHH or tweet us at PCHH. And when we come back, it'll be time to talk about what's making us happy this week. So come right back.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Capital One. Welcome to banking reimagined. Capital One checking and savings accounts have no fees or minimums and a top-rated banking app that lets you manage your money anytime, anywhere. Check on the account balance, deposit checks, pay bills, and transfer money on the go. This is banking reimagined. What's in your wallet? Capital One N.A., member FDIC.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Teladoc. Teladoc is here for you with 24/7 access to board-certified doctors who can diagnose and treat non-emergency conditions like sinus infections, allergies, rashes, and more. And Teladoc's doctors can, where authorized, call in a prescription to be filled at the pharmacy of your choice. Download the app today or visit teladoc.com/NPR.
Welcome back to Pop Culture Happy Hour. It's time for our favorite segment of this week and every week, What's Making Us Happy? Brittany, let's start with you.
I was having a rough patch a couple weeks back. Won't get into that. But I finally decided to sit down and watch Better Things, the show by Pamela Adlon on FX. I had seen like half of an episode before, but like pandemic depression was clouding my mind. I couldn't pay attention. I couldn't follow what was going on. But I just sat down and I watched the first season 2 times in a row because I watched it once by myself. And then my fiance started watching with me and he was like, oh, I need to go. I was like, I'll go back with you. I watched all these yesterday, but I'll watch them again. We just finished the last episode of the 4th season, which came out last year. And what Pamela Adlon is doing on that show,
yes,
is something unlike anything that I've seen, not just from like the themes around being a working mother, but also being like a sandwich caretaker, like taking care of parent and children. She just also has so much to say about like what it means to be a working artist. And also like just the way that she approaches the show, like a true auteur, like writing and directing like most of the episodes since season 2. It has a feel, like this very lived-in, loving feel, unlike any other television show that I've seen in a long time, maybe ever. And I really, really have enjoyed watching it. Like, I actually just might go back and start the whole series over again. It's that good. So, Better Things. Highly recommend. You can catch it on Hulu.
I am so glad you recommended that because it is such a great show. And so it, for me, it's like one of my top 3 of mother-daughter relationships on screen. I just think it's fantastic.
Oh, it's so good.
Eric, how about you? What is making you happy?
So I also have been in need of some escapist kind of content lately. For me, there has been no other place than Discovery Plus. I actually am like, I am the biggest Discovery Plus fan out there. There's just so much good reality show content, whether it's HGTV stuff, you know, your Property Brothers, your, you know, your Chip and Joanna Gaines. You've also got like Lifetime, 90 Day Fiancé, which is actually TLC. You've got like Married at First Sight thrown in it. There's just everything, whatever your flavor is, it's in there. And the thing in there that I want to recommend the most is Ready to Love, this dating competition show that airs on OWN. It is amazing. I love it so much. The thing that kind of makes it different, it's not kind of the normal dating crowd. So like normally on the dating shows, you know, folks are like 22 to like 20, maybe 28. Mm-hmm. You know, people treat 28 on dating shows like it's like 55. but like this is actually about an older set. It's you know, it's almost all Black people. They're usually in Atlanta or Houston, and they all range in age from about the youngest being like 32, 33, all the way up to around like early 50s. And so you get to see your favorite auntie, you know, the uncle that you hate, like the cat daddy. Like you get to see all these people kind of coming together to try to like date in this modern age and fail at it terribly. But it's so fun. It's so like earnest. And you eventually, even though you kind of hate a lot of the people, you're like, I'm still rooting for you to find love at the end. So, you know, if you're a fan of OWN, definitely check out Ready to Love. If you haven't checked out Discovery Plus, there is something in there for you. Oh, man, it's such a deep well.
I love it. I love it. Cat daddies and aunties dating. I'm all about it.
It's beautiful.
So what is making me happy this week and a lot recently is actually just older Hollywood stars on Twitter being really fun and cool. Just the other day, there was a video that Anthony Hopkins tweeted. It's a tweet of him dancing. He's just kind of like moving around. The music is playing in the background. It's like maybe a minute long. And he's just so cute and it's adorable. And he looks so happy and fun. And it just made me think of like, I follow all of these older celebrities on Twitter. And some of them are really good at Twitter. I think, of course, of Dionne Warwick.
The goat.
Ed Asner is also really great at Twitter. He's like kind of saucy and just very, you know, politically minded, but also like tweeting at like Seth Rogen and Jonah Hill. Like, I appreciate that they are embracing this platform and hearing their voice, even if they're not necessarily in as many things anymore or appearing on screen in the same way that we are used to seeing them. It's just really nice to have that. And so it's really simple, but I just love older celebrities on Twitter. So follow Anthony Hopkins. Ed Asner is great. Obviously, Dionne Warwick. The list goes on. And that's what's making me happy this week. If you want links for what we recommended, plus some more recommendations exclusive to the newsletter, subscribe to our newsletter at npr.org/popculturenewsletter. And before we go, we wanted to let you know that we are going to be doing an episode about the best Muppets. And we want to know which Muppets you think are the best. You can vote for your favorite Muppets at npr.org/Muppets. Again, vote for your favorite Muppet at npr.org/Muppets. And that brings us to the end of our show. You can find all of us on Twitter. Find me at Crafting My Style. Follow Brittany at BM Loose. And you can follow Eric at E Eddings. Follow editor Jessica Reedy at Jessica_Reedy and producer Candace Lim at TheCandaceLim. You can follow producer Mallory Yu at Mallory_Yu. And follow producer Mike Katziff at Mike Katziff. That's KATZIF. Mike's band Hello Come In provides the music you are bobbing your head to right now. Thanks to you both for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you. I'm still marinating on that movie. Oh, man.
And thanks for listening to Pop Culture Happy Hour from NPR. We'll see you all next week when we will be talking about the season finale of WandaVision.
Hey, it's Ophira Eisenberg, host of Ask Me Another. I love film, food, TV, and clothes, so I was thrilled to talk with clothing designer, restaurateur, and Fresh Off the Boat series creator Eddie Huang about his debut film, Boogie, and play a game with him. Listen now to the Ask Me Another podcast from NPR.